have always found the first Sunday after the first Tuesday after the first Monday of every fourth year to be an appropriate occasion for a bit of pinpricking. We need to discharge some of the excessive electricity of the lecturing hyperbole. We need to calm our own exaggerated hopes and fears. For after all, Mondays, saints and sinners, the man on the white horse, the man in the red devil's mask, are today, again, our fellow citizens, our lawmakers, and our ministers. You know, it's true. The long history of American politics, elections have rarely signaled a major reorganization of the body politic. In this century, on only one occasion, 1932, did the election mandate a basic restructuring of the way by which we are governed. Taken as a whole, the line of the growth of American political life is remarkably steady. We've had in this century 6 changes in party administration, 11 different men of presidents. We have as a whole continued a rather steady and single-minded approach the way with the wish to be governed. Change in American political life tends to be piecemeal. A problem presents itself, it insists on some kind of legislation, and we devise and invent a program to meet it. Our judgments about political change tend to be taken pragmatically. Is this the best of all alternative solutions? Have we the fiscal strength with which to support the program? Do we have the staff, a necessary resource? We work. Indeed, even the major changes of the media were taken within the familiar pragmatic structure of American political life. President Roosevelt did not approach a bankrupt installed economy with any ideological preconception, any theoretical architecture into which American life had to fit and to be crammed. Rather, he improvised as he went along, specific solutions to specific problems. He and his advisors brainstormed to find the practical solutions that could give to our economy a new lease on life and the necessary and neat strength. We have brought to the political arena our hope rather than our fears. Americans have not taken over from their European ancestors the European concern for political philosophy, for ideology. We tend to tinker rather than to theorize. We tend to be practical rather than to philosophize. We tend to be idealists rather than to be ideologues. There is a broadly agreed upon American dream, but there is no broadly agreed upon narrow American doctrine of government. One way, and one way only, which our national life can grow. I remember saying this to you 4 years ago this Sunday. President-elect Kennedy had spoken much during his campaign, as you recall, of new frontiers. He had an almost Rooseveltian sense of the importance of the first 100 days. Many feared that the American processes would be abruptly changed and turned aside. And I suggested then that what Mr. Kennedy had in mind was a new direction rather than a new direction. But he wanted to stop the process by which political problems were being swept under any convenient rug. But he insisted upon a new vigorous approach specific solutions to specific problems, but now. Time, of course, proved this to be the case. Compare, if you will, President Kennedy's assumption of office with that of the Labour government in England during the past month. The Wilson is, of course, wrestled with specific economic problems. But he was also tossed into the parliamentary hopper, a bill which would provide for the nationalization of the basic units of steel production. Now, Mr. Wilson has not argued that this nationalization is required because of any urgency in British economic life. But rather, he has argued that it is right, that it is proper for the people as a whole, to own the basic units of production. And my point is not to argue here the theory of nationalization. Mr. Wilson may very well be right. It is simply to suggest to you that in European politics, men theorize and they legislate according to their theory. Nationalization of steel is drawn more from the axioms of European socialism than from the practical necessity of England's present-day economic crisis. President Kennedy, 4 years ago, devised legislation to meet practical problems specifically. The Manpower Retraining Act became law because tens of thousands of men and women were out of jobs. The jobs had been erased and canceled by automation. And they faced a lifelong gridiron unless some agency of government would retrain them, provide them with new skills which added some economic value in the new labor market. The Area Redevelopment Act, the so-called distressed areas bill, became law because such was the pattern of our economic growth that some areas lagged behind. They were full of obsolete plants. They were overwhelmed by a pool of unemployed labor. At the very time when we needed money for public welfare, for the retraining program to draw in the industry, their tax base was starved and their treasuries were strapped. These areas needed some kind of federal aid. President Kennedy's method was the traditional American method of politics, problem solving, practical, pragmatic. Typical of this approach has been the proposals over the last 6 months taken by President Johnson, in which he has organized 15 task forces of citizens and experts. And we charge each to concern itself with one of the major areas of American life. Conservation, trade, labor, race relations, and the like. And he charged these groups to analyze the field given them, to review on the government policy, and to suggest new areas in which governmental energy might be welcome. He did not charge any of these 15 task forces to report a party line, to draw up their conclusions in a party lingo in the frame of work reference of some political theory or ideology. Rather, he said, analyze and suggest, and then the administration will see what is feasible and what can be made part of our American way. Now, this process of political growth by problem solving is always, it is, of course, the bane of ideologues of all stripes. It's not very neat. And those who need to cram life under some convenient labor before they feel secure and at ease never know what to make of the American economy. It is part free, part regulated. We call ourselves a free enterprise economy, but of course we know that large segments of the economy belong to the welfare state and the socialist state also. The task force, of course, is, does it work? And the answer is that so far it has worked and worked well. And so we shrug off the taunts and the damning of the ideologues of figures in the central control who say that what we are doing is only palliative, not enough. We shrug off the damning of the disciples and dogmatists of free enterprise who say that what we are achieving is some form of creeping socialism. The test for us is not the label, but the effect. And the proof of the pudding lies in the prosperity, the decency, and the dignity of American life. And so it is that the Manpower Recruiting Act, the Rural Development Bill, and all of the companion legislation of the last administration, the extension of coverage under the minimum wage, the various housing and slum clearance programs, the farm subsidy bills that were continued, the Small Business Administration Act, all of these and their rights gave us 4 years of unrivaled prosperity. We did make some inroads on the gray areas of the economy. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. For us, the proof of our national life is in its success. To judge that success, I would remind you that 4 years ago, the Kennedy administration was about to assume office. 5.5 million Americans were unemployed. Economists really predicted that 2 million more of our American citizens would be unemployed within 6 months. We had just stumbled through 2 recessions in the last 3.5 years. 100,000 American citizens were exhausting their qualifications for unemployment insurance and public relief each month. And there seemed to be danger that the American economy was truly grinding to a halt. I say this as preamble to the suggestion that the mandate which President Johnson received Tuesday last is essentially this. He asked him to continue this pragmatic and practical and reasonable approach to policy. His faith is a revolutionary age. His faith is new demands, new stresses and strains in our way of life and our economy. And we asked him to continue this traditional pragmatic approach. We didn't want a major reorientation, major restructuring of our world. We didn't want an ideology. We did not want any philosophic preconception, any corset, any straitjacket into which American life had to be crammed. Rather, we wanted specific solutions to specific problems as these arose. What these specific solutions will be, indeed what the specific problems of the next 4 years will be, remains hidden from us by the mists of time. In all probability, the first years of the new administration will be spent in consolidation, in understanding what has already been achieved. For the major days of the Kennedy administration became law only in the last month of the Johnson administration. And we have yet to explore, to understand, and indeed to put into effect their major provisions. There is, for instance, the Exciting Economic Opportunity Act of 1964, so-called Poverty Bill. This act is the first major statement by the federal government of its concern for remedial education, for the employment of youth, to enrich the land of starvation, the gray area of the city slum and of the city sidewalk, with manpower, with organization, with all that which can reach down in and help these deprived young people to come to a rightful place within our American prosperity. The Economic Opportunities Act was designed to be a cooperative effort between the communities and the federal government. The communities were to draw up a suggestion of programs, local programs, tailored to their own needs. that these are to be approved by the Poverty Bill Administrator. Cleveland has just, 2 months ago, submitted to Washington our preliminary proposals. These are wide-ranging and far-reaching. We proposed an adult high school, adult literacy classes, work training in and out of schools, preschool education centers, sufficient funds so that our school buildings can be open day and night for children and adults alike, as enrichment centers and leisure time agencies. We ask for money to train the handicapped in certain workshops. We ask for money to reach out with counseling and housekeeping aid to free the deprived homes so that the individuals in these homes can go to school, stay in school, and when necessary, go to work to provide advanced education for the young. All this is asked and more. But if you see a paper program, we have yet to see the first result, the first building. And all probability, President Johnson will wait until these programs have had some years to develop before he asks for new legislation in this particular area. What will be demanded of him is efficient administration, energetic administration. It will be demanded of him not only by the poverty bill, by the Civil Rights Bill which passed Congress last year. The paper dragon of the last election was the so-called white backlash. Many Americans may not enjoy the frustration of getting over their inherited prejudices. But most Americans are sufficient dignity to want an open and equal society. And they said so. By their vote, an overwhelming number of the code. I want to insist on now on the part of our federal government is a vigorous administration of the rights guaranteed by law and by the Constitution. The right to vote, opportunity in housing, opportunity in employment, and the like. We said by our vote on Tuesday last, we are not only indignant at the continuing violence in Mississippi, the burnings and the racial murders which go unpunished. We are indignant with the outrage at our own back door. That which keeps some men from being our neighbors. That which divides the city, half white and half Negro. That which divides the city from the suburb and the suburb from the city. We have determined that employment opportunities shall be open to all, that there shall no longer be closed racial shops within unions. That we are determined that our neighborhoods shall be open to all, that there shall no longer be racial covenants, restrictive barriers against those who wish to live near us and among us. We said, too, that we will somehow find within our hearts not only understanding and tolerance, but sympathy. The urgency of Negro demand will bridle our tongues and our occasional frustration of Negro strategy. We disapprove of a particular program, and we will see to it that we do not lend aid and comfort to the bigot. And what we demand of the federal government is effective, vigorous enforcement. The laws which are now on the book. I look to the next year, a year of growth and consolidation. I think it will be good years. The last 12 months have seen the American people mobilize its own decency in law and in vote, and make clear, patently clear, to those in control of government. Where is this society to go? Where it has always been destined to go. Take goodness, take openness, take the decency which each man owes to his neighbor. And the cost of the next years will then be both on the administration and on the citizens. For increasingly, the programs which have been devised by the federal government depend upon a local base of support, local initiative, and local arrangement. Cleveland must see to it that the poverty bill becomes an effective tool against poverty here in the city. The government will provide the money. We must provide the manpower, the morality, the determination. And what stands in our way? What stands in our way as we begin a new administration? Very little. An abundant, prosperous nation. Our strength is unrivaled because we can easily accept our present population and far more. What stands in our way? Only our own political preconceptions. I'm afraid that whatever be our place in the political spectrum, a little bit of standard gray water rubbed off on each of us. Each of us is tending to bring to the political arena his own particular brand of ideology, of political presupposition. Tell us that a bill is sponsored by a senator of the left and we immediately damn it without knowing its content. Tell us that a bill is supported by a particular senator of the right and another group of Americans immediately damn its content. Once upon a time, a bill proposed in the legislature was debated on its merits. But frankly, this debate has been largely absent in our American life. We have been a nation of laborers, liberal, conservative, extremist, moderate, red, black, pink. We've accepted for ourselves, I'm afraid, also some of these political pigeonholes, these political labels. I've seen on many of your own library tables, one or another of these carefully drawn up sheets which show how each member of the federal legislature voted on each bill, and which rate these votes according to some assumed absolute standard of Americanism. And these sheets are not only drawn up by the extremist lunatic fringe of American life. Most of us have come to assume, one way or another, that there is an American way, a single way, an only way, for government to act. And if any deviation from this assumed norm, which is really our own hypostasized prejudice, but any deviation from this assumed norm is almost hell. No, I'm not speaking now of the extreme. Extremist is always a statement of his own. This world is a world of the paranoid. It's psychopathic. You're dangerous to be sure. I'm speaking of us. You know. The way in which we are approaching our political problems. None of us would willingly lend aid and comfort to a segregation. But let the segregationists suggest that there is a constitutional issue, states' rights involved in the civil rights game, how many are tempted to join the enemy camp? How many of us remember in our making our political decisions, as Justice Holmes once said, that America is an experiment, not a conclusion? The American Constitution is a guideline for growth, not a party line from which no deviation is ever committed. And none of us would willingly go in to deny to the worker his right to unionize. Collective bargaining has brought dignity and a high standard of living and decency to a wide range of the American working class. Let the fat cats of the anywhere in my view that there is a constitutional issue, an American issue, the right to vote, to which how many of us join with them in arguing for their special and genial self-interest? How many of us remember that America is an experiment, not a conclusion? But the Constitution provides guidelines for growth, not a party line, not a party line, to which no deviation is committed. And none of us would willingly tolerate irresponsibility in government, irresponsibility in labor, or irresponsibility in management, or irresponsibility in the farming community. And let any of these vested interests argue that government regulation is an arbitrary interference in the mechanics of a free enterprise. How many of us are tempted to agree that those special interests, those vested concerns are somehow sanctioned and above all beliefs? All of us, I'm afraid, have been guilty in these past years of judging by labels, of assuming that there is a single way. Constitution provides a very narrow highway that you must walk carefully along. Never to the right, never to the left, but only one step ahead of you. The enterprise is one of these dangerous, wonderful, exciting, misleading rules. Series that fall far from the truth. In the 15th century, free enterprise has never existed in the American economy. The very first bill passed by a constitutional Congress was a tariff bill, an arbitrary intrusion of government policy in the marketplace. And since that first bill, we have interfered to protect the businessman, and then to protect the laboring man, and then to protect the farmer, and finally to protect the consumer. Whenever we have interfered in the mechanisms of free enterprise in the marketplace, we have done so because a community requires regulation, because city streets require traffic lights, because the weak require protection from the strong, because some measure of protection allows the society to grow, to progress, to become something more than the indecency of the jungle. American life has grown because Americans as a whole have been anti-idea, anti-philosophic in their approach to government. Because it came to government without preconception and strangely distorted views. Our people have been governed for the long centuries by remarkable variety of political organizations. We have had tribal confederations. We've been governed by kings. We've been governed by oriental despots. We've had a theocracy. We've had an aristocracy of the learned. We've had a very rudimentary town hall kind of democracy in the settle. And finally, as we are today, as a socialist democracy. Our tradition has never made any one form of political organization sacrosanct. We have never required any dogmatic of political theory. Rather, our tradition has insisted the obituia from the first that is not the form of government so much as the ways in which the government exists as a form. We have concentrated on the goal, on righteousness, on justice, on the broadest quality of freedom, and the establishment of peace, and the establishment of institutions which promote the decency of men, the promote education and learning and leisure, all these and more. Now, Judaism has never insisted that each generation confines itself to some ideal preconception of what government must be. We have never had a Plato. The dream for us, the ideal state, its ideal laws, its ideal rulers, the philosophy of things, and then he argued that all life must somehow be trained into this one artificial construct of his own mind. Our prophets
A rabbi is insisting that it, whatever be the form of government being best in that age, that government must reflect the basic moral law, three Ten Commandments, and more. That is the judgment by which we judge the propriety of law in the earth. I read to you this morning from Jeremiah. Jeremiah lived in the days of the kings of Israel. He knew his monarchy. He judged the monarchy in terms that he could hear. But he might apply this judgment equally to an oligarchy, to an aristocracy, to a democracy. This is the final judgment, the final step that you must impose on any government. Let's tell it the Lord. Go down to the house of the king of Judah and speak there these words. Execute justice and righteousness. Deliver the spoil out of the hand of the oppressor. And do no wrong. Do no violence to the stranger, the fatherless, nor the widow. Shed not innocent blood in this place. If you do these things, then they shall enter in by these great kings sitting upon the throne of Israel. If you may not hear these words, I swear to the Lord, this palace shall become a desolation. What is the framework of our own basic organization of life say? The language is the language of the Bible. In order to promote a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, to promote the general welfare and to secure the blessings of liberty. It's a biblical dream, this is the American dream, this is the biblical way, and this is the American way. How dare strip demands of righteousness based upon the authority in authority, whatever be the form of their authority, their ultimate responsibility to the moral life. With this, there is no compromise. The forms by which the society is determined to organize its life that can be the base. It's up to the ingenuity and to the wisdom of each age. And with the fundamental purpose of government, there can be no difference. So let's put aside for the next 4 years all of these ideological teaching texts. All of these American first kinds of things which have begun to cut up at me. Let's look again at the ruins now. Let's look again at our truth. The gray world of poverty, the slum, criticism, and the black world of discrimination and of prejudice where men are locked out of the sense. Let's not argue philosophic theory, and I'm not imploring hype, failing to see the broken lives, the sight of growth, and the need. Let's look at our society and ask what is demanded to make it even a better society. Honor, faith, and students. This is the prophecy that we ask it to enter. The chosen act of our answer to it. We have found in it again the strenuous American dynamic of growth. That which has brought us to this height. That which will permit us to grow. Yes. That is the only thing.